Hello, and welcome to Clinicians Brief Partner Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm your host, Dr. Katie Berlin, and I'm so pleased to be joined today by our guest, Dr. Grant Beckett. Today's episode is made possible by our industry partner, Boehringer Ingelheim. And Dr. Beckett, thank you so much for being here. Would you mind giving us just a little bit of background about yourself?
Thank you so much for having me, and good day to everybody. I appreciate the opportunity on behalf of Boehringer Ingelheim, and please call me Grant.
Okay.
Yes, so I am a graduate of Onderzoekpoort, which is the Faculty of Veterinary Sciences in my homeland, South Africa. I did work in private and emergency practice for many years in South Africa, also in the United Kingdom and Australia. I did come to the United States to transition to an opportunity in industry and have worked with several companies like Monsanto, Fort Dodge Animal Health, and now with Boehringer Ingelheim. Currently, I am the Associate Technical Director for Companion Animal Therapeutics.
All right. That's great. I had a favorite professor in vet school who was from South Africa, and he liked to say, we were in upstate New York, and he liked to say he left South Africa because they got too much sun. Well, it was not a problem in upstate New York. Anyway, Grant, before we get started, I just have one question for you. What is one thing that's guaranteed to lower your blood pressure when you're really stressed?
Ah, great question, Katie. Interestingly enough, we have this very sweet but completely deaf cat. Her name is Leilani. And so when I'm feeling a little stressed, what she and I do is just to go into our backyard, and we just go and take big gulps of fresh air and just watch Mother Nature passing us by. So that usually is a really nice de-stressor. And Leilani helps me get through.
I love that. Our pets definitely do help remind us to take a minute, I think, and just breathe. So that's great. And as you all might have guessed, today we're going to be talking about something that veterinary professionals probably relate to on a pretty visceral level these days, which is hypertension. But of course, we're not talking about the jumps in blood pressure like we have every day in the clinic, like say the third client in one morning who doesn't answer their phone when they show up late for their curbside appointment. This is a totally hypothetical example, of course. But today, we're talking about that persistent pathologic hypertension in those mystical beings like Leilani, who deign to walk among us, cats. And as we all know, it can be really hard even to diagnose hypertension in cats. I'm a little bit ashamed to admit that sometimes I dread having to try to get a good Doppler reading on a cat and then interpret it when that cat is awake. Grant, in what situations do you feel like we really need to try to get that decent blood pressure measurement in our kitty patients?
Great question, Katie. And I'd really like to start with saying that the best thing to really start is to look at the updated 2018 ACVIM guidelines for the identification, evaluation, and management of systemic hypertension, because this really helps answer your question. But essentially what they're saying is that the profile of the cat that is the really good candidate for blood pressure screening is based on a couple of metrics. So firstly, of course, is age, right? And we now have some very strong evidence that show that age is a primary risk factor with a significant increase in systemic blood pressure with advancing age. A nice paper was published in 2015 by Dr. Beeschmans and her colleagues in JVM. And there's some outstanding published data that she put there that showed that both in healthy cats and those that either had or then subsequently developed renal disease, there's this advancement in blood pressure. The other risk factor, of course, is clinical presentation of any abnormalities that might be consistent with hypertensive target organ damage, or TOD, as we know it. So these signals of TOD are pretty well circumscribed. They include retinopathies, choroidopathies, any kind of neurological signs or deficits, renal abnormalities like azotemia or proteinuria, and then finally any kind of cardiovascular issues such as arrhythmias or systolic murmurs. So indeed, in my opinion, any healthy, middle-aged, or older cat should absolutely be a candidate for blood pressure screening, and certainly any cat with any kind of evidence of the target organ damage that I was referencing.
That's both great to know, and also, of course, what I didn't want to hear, which is that blood pressure screening should really be part of our senior screening plan that we recommend for most cats as they reach middle age. I mean, we may not love having to do it, but it definitely, seems like it's important.
Absolutely. Katie, it's also worth noting, really at the outset here, that there are so many complexities around hypertension, and especially as we've been talking about our friend the cat. There's a lot of the chicken or egg relationship going on between hypertension and certain very specific diseases. And that just not only adds to the complexity, but it speaks to the challenges that clinicians face when confronted with these kinds of patients. Secondary hypertension is by far the most common classification of hypertension, and this is defined as persistent and pathological increase in blood pressure concurrent with a disease or condition known to cause hypertension. The dominant condition implicated by far is chronic kidney disease, and there are definitely some compelling data to support this interconnection. So if you look at the literature, up to about 65% of cats with kidney disease are hypertensive. And conversely, up to three quarters of cats with high blood pressure had clear signs of renal disease. Another condition, of course, that I don't want to neglect and to put on the radar of the listener is hyperthyroidism. So the literature would indicate that the prevalence here is a little more, spans a little bit more in terms of numbers from sort of the low teens up to 90%. But hypertension with this disease, both pre and post-treatment, is definitely one to think about. Treating the hypothyroid cat concurrently with especially hypertension is very, very important.
Okay, thank you. That's a question I was going to ask you, which is whether we should wait to address the blood pressure in hyperthyroid cats until their thyroid is controlled. I think that's been something I've wondered about probably for a long time. It's so easy to come up with reasons to wait to measure that blood pressure and say, well, we'll start treating the hyperthyroidism first. And I think one of the biggest challenges for many of us is actually getting an accurate blood pressure reading on a cat in the exam room between stress and movement artifact. There are a lot of reasons why we don't always feel confident in the readings that we get. Do you have any advice where that's concerned?
I get asked that question so frequently. How do we get those accurate, consistent blood pressure readings, especially in awake cats, right? Which is clinical reality. While recognizing that this variable is often the reason that the hypertensive cat is not diagnosed and then by default not treated, I want to be completely empathic to the long list of challenges that veterinarians and clinics may be facing when thinking about this as a diagnostic tool. The good news, though, is that there are now plentiful resources out there to be accessed for both help and support. The ACVIM guidelines that I was referring to earlier include a detailed section on blood pressure measuring considerations, and our friends at the International Society of Feline Medicine, the ISFM, has got a really nice series of helpful online tools that also cover this topic in great detail, including some really thorough how-to videos which cover the most commonly used devices used to measure blood pressure.
Thank you, Grant. That's so helpful. And if we can, we'll link to some of those resources in the show notes because I think those videos especially would be very helpful for a lot of our listeners. If you don't mind, now I'd like to take a second to go over a little bit of the biology of hypertension and how the major treatments options work that we have. So nobody run away. This is kind of a fun flashback to biology. I'm sure our listeners remember learning about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, or RAAS, in school, but many of us are probably a little bit rusty, including myself. So, Grant, would you please talk about that for us just a bit?
Oh, Katie, who wouldn't love a little bit of a RAS review, right?
Yes.
Something we can all probably review every once in a while. So let's start off by saying that the RAS itself is a very dynamic and critical player in not only the regulation of blood pressure, but also body fluid volume, and electrolyte balance in all mammals. Unfortunately, though, when blood flow to the kidneys is diminished, the kidneys then secrete renin from the juxtaglomerular cells. And renin is the enzyme which catalyzes the conversion of a plasma glycoprotein known as angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1, right, which is then found in the plasma. This, the latter is very rapidly hydrolyzed to an active, which is known simply as angiotensin 2. And that is done by the angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE, which we're all very, very familiar with. So angiotensin 2 as the active causes the vasoconstriction and therefore increases total peripheral resistance. And so we get that increase in blood pressure. Once the blood pressure goes up, we are now getting the renal perfusion that was initially triggered by kidneys that weren't getting the GFR that they were looking for. Angiotensin 2 also has another function in that it increases the secretion of aldosterone by the adrenal glands. And aldosterone, as we all know, causes both sodium and water retention, increases blood pressure, and enhances potassium secretion. Once again, another mechanism to restore renal perfusion. Collectively, these responses then are responsible for inhibiting the signal for renin release in that feedback mechanism.
I have all these diagrams from vet school textbooks running through my head right now. So if the RAS is responsible for the prolonged hypertension that we see in cats with CKD, then it would make sense to try to address the hypertension by going directly to that system. Is that right?
Absolutely. Inappropriate stimulation of this RAS appears to be present in many, many cats that present with CKD. Chronic excessive RAS activation may lead to the development of systemic hypertension and, of course, then ongoing detrimental effects to the kidneys themselves. So indeed, getting a handle on what factors are involved, especially a persistent activated RAS, should frame the clinical approach to each and every one of these feline patients.
Okay, so in light of that, Grant, what would you consider to be the first-line treatment for hypertension in cats, and what factors are you considering in choosing that drug?
Yes, Katie. So obviously for us, we believe that Zemintra, that's our telmisartan oral solution, should absolutely be the first choice for feline hypertension, starting mainly with its unique and targeted mode of action. So the active component in Zemintra, telmisartan, goes to work by insurmountably and selectively binding the critical AT1 receptors. And so that prevents the vasoconstrictive and therefore hypertensive cascade, which is affected by that AT1 receptor. On the other side, beneficial effects like naturesis and vasodilation affected by the AT2 receptor are spared because Zemintra has no effect there. Zemintra works equally well both modulating a chronically activated RAS or primary hypertension using the RAS to its benefit. Either way, Zemintra is the one that acts as a primary lever on the hypertension cycle, obviously modulated by our friend, the RAS that we've just been talking about. So that's more sort of the mechanism of action. But beside this, Zemintra also brings a host of unique features and benefits that veterinarians might find very appreciated when managing these patients, our friends, the cats, right? So let's first start with the fact that Zemintra is a liquid formulation. So no pills, no tablets. Perhaps we can pause a moment to let that sink in, Katie. Zemintra is highly accepted by feline patients. And I think this translates into a convenient and stress-free administrative experience, both not only for the cat, but also for the cat owner. It can be dosed directly into the mouth, on top of food, or even next to food. And so I think Zemintra really goes a long way to not compromising the very important human-animal bond. Additionally, Zemintra has a calibrated syringe. And what does that mean? It means both accurate dosing and precision dosing. So important in establishing the fact that the cat will always get the exact dose as prescribed by the veterinarian. And finally, I'd also like to mention that Zemintra is currently the only FDA-approved medication for the control of systemic hypertension in cats. It has obviously been rigorously tested, both for safety and efficacy, and we've clearly demonstrated that Zemintra will both safely and effectively lower the blood pressure within the first 14 days, and then can be administered as a once daily solution on a maintenance basis for those patients.
Grant, you are absolutely right that I just needed to take a moment to let that sink in, that you don't have to give your cat a pill, because my own very spicy cat just got sick recently. She's a CKD patient, not hypertensive yet, thankfully, but I had to pill her several times a day when she had this episode, and she was mad at me. And I am relating to these dosing features on a very personal level right now, and I know that many of our listeners will too. So is it fair to say that you think that Symintra is the gold standard now for first-line treatment of hypertension in cats?
I do, Katie. I believe the pedigree that I've just laid out there clearly justifies our claim as it being a gold standard.
And as the gold standard, you know, we'll be using it a lot. But I think it's important now, if you wouldn't mind, to share some safety information that our listeners should be aware of when they're considering using it for their hypertensive kitty patients.
Very, very important, Katie, and very happy to do so. So the most common side effects reported in multiple field studies include vomiting, diarrhea, lethargy, dehydration, decreased appetite, and weight loss. Many of these cats in these studies, of course, had CKD or other underlying diseases. So that obviously may explain the prevalence of some of these side effects. However, effects that are directly attributable to the pharmacological action of Symintra at the recommended treatment dose would include reduction in blood pressure and additionally decreases in red blood cell counts. Please note that Symintra has not been evaluated in cats with systolic blood pressure greater than 200 millimeters of mercury. Also, the safe use of Symintra has not been evaluated in cats with hepatic disease, cats that are less than 9 months of age, or cats that are either pregnant, lactating, or intended for breeding.
Thank you, Grant. I would like to ask too, because, you know, I know we're all used to using other medications to treat hypertension in cats. And I'd like, if you wouldn't mind, to know what the difference is between Symintra and the other options that we use, drugs like amlodipine, benazepril, atenolol. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Of course. And I want to recognize that all of those that you mentioned are used universally, not only for this disease, but for many other conditions. So let's start with amlodipine, which, as we all know, is not FDA approved for use in cats, but definitely, as I said, used to manage and treat hypertension in cats, and at many levels is definitely effective. But I think we need to take a closer look at some of the potential shortcomings of amlodipine. It belongs to a class, as we know, known as the calcium channel blockers, and works peripherally at the level of the vascular endothelium in order to facilitate vasodilation. So really, it has no ability to deal with that RAS that we were talking about, right? Whether it's an activated RAS chronically, amlodipine has no effect there. And indeed, there are some data, Katie, that would suggest that amlodipine might even be complicit in triggering the RAS. So something for clinicians to think about.
Yeah.
Additionally, if you look at the kidneys, specifically at the glomerular level, calcium channel blockers are known to be very preferential vasodilators of the afferent arteriole. And so this is, again, something to consider, especially in the CKD patient, because we do know that Symintra is what is known as a balanced glomerular vasodilator. So both the afferent and efferent arteriole are acted upon, ensuring a reduction on critical intraglomerular high blood pressure. So in the case a clinician might need to, in fact, add drugs to amlodipine to help counterbalance this glomerular, very often something like an ACE inhibitor might be selected if the cat, for example, is proteinuric or has other pathologies like tubular interstitial fibrosis, related, of course, to progressive renal disease. So definitely something that we would add as a consideration when selecting amlodipine. From a presentation perspective, amlodipine is primarily a generic tablet formation. And I think with your spicy cat recollection there, I think we all know about cats and tablets. So dosing time can be a stressful time. And obviously, the other thing that we think about is the actual dose itself. So I think all of us that we're in practice recognize that when you're having to break up tablets, even the score tablets, getting an accurate dose is not always as easy as if you had a liquid using a calibrated syringe. So I think Symmetra offers some huge advances there in effectively managing hypertension in these patients.
Okay, so that makes sense. I have not thought this much about renal physiology since vet school, so this is a much needed review for me. But that makes sense that amlodipine is only addressing the hypertension with vasodilation, but it isn't dealing with the RAS at all and might even activate it. That's something I didn't know. And it's not working on pressure inside the glomerulus at all. And cats and pills. Enough said, I think, about that. So what about drugs like vinazapril or enalapril?
Yes. Vinazapril obviously belongs to the class of ACE inhibitors we're all familiar with. And sadly, this class does not perform well at all as a monotherapy for managing hypertension in cats, and is absolutely not recommended as a monotherapy for that. The only time that ACE inhibitors like vinazapril might come in handy, as I mentioned, Katie, was as an adjunct therapy if amlodipine obviously is helping with hypertension, but you might have proteinuria or some other renal issues, especially glomerular issues, that you would require the ACE inhibitor to be able to counteract. So guess what? We now have two tablets, right?
We've got the no. No, not more tablets.
Exactly. You did also mention the beta blockers like atenolol.
Yes.
And so, yes, indeed, you know, atenolol may definitely be useful to control something like heart rate, especially in tachycardic patients with, say, hyperthyroidism. However, this drug class has a very negligible antihypertensive effect and so are not, again, recommended as a monotherapy for cats for this indication.
Grant, thank you so much for all of that insight. I know that I'm feeling a lot more confident about tackling this next time I need to in the exam room. And I thought I knew how to manage feline hypertension already. I mean, how often does that happen, right? That we think we know something and then new advances come along and we realize we have to rethink it. And just because something's been working, quote unquote, well enough, doesn't always mean it's the best option. And I feel like this is a really good example of how no matter how consciously we try to learn new things and evolve in this profession, we can get kind of stuck. I mean, I graduated in 2009, and in my head, I'm still a recent grad who's bringing the new stuff into the practice, but I'm really not that person anymore. In my head, I'm still 29, but that's also not true. So in reality, we have to be able to incorporate the new things that we learn into the methods that we've learned to rely on after accumulating all of this experience. And on that note, we've made it to our Keep It Brief section. And so I'd like to ask you about that a little bit, what I was just mentioning, the evolution. You know, what, in your experience, what's the number one piece of advice that you can give to our listeners about staying on top of this ever-changing creature that is veterinary medicine?
I absolutely believe that what it comes down to is determining what is the most efficient way for us to really hone in and find innovation. And certainly if the last 18 months have taught me anything, it's that there are now so many virtual opportunities to seek out really good information. This podcast and so many other offerings through Clinician's Brief are an excellent example. So many groups have gotten really good at putting excellent content out there. And much of that content, as you know, is presented in the form of continuing education. Finally, Katie, I think I would be remiss, of course, if I didn't mention that even at Boehringer Ingelheim, some of our brands have their own websites, right? So like Symmetra.com would be a good example. And you can get many of your questions answered right there. We also have biconnect.com. So that's bi-connect.com. And that's also a one-stop portal that we have to many of the educational offerings presented by Boehringer Ingelheim.
Thank you so much, Grant, for taking this time with us today and for providing that really thorough look at hypertension and our options now. I know this has been super valuable for me, and I know our listeners will think so too. And thank you also to our partner, Boehringer Ingelheim, for making this conversation possible. And thanks to all of you listening. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks again to our sponsor and to today's guest for joining us. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, please make sure that you subscribe, rate, and review. We would appreciate if you leave us all of the stars. You can also listen to podcasts on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. And you can drop us a line at podcasts@briefmedia.com. Clinician's Brief Partner Podcasts is a Brief Media production.